And all I need now is intellectual intercourse, a soul to dig the hole much deeper. I have no concept of time, other than it's flying. Alanis Morissette, All I Really Want. I chose this quote because it's something I'd read in the Guardian article written on the 20th anniversary of the novel's publication last year, linked in the show notes. It's one of those strange Jungian serendipities that travels with this dark book. As soon as I'd finished taking notes on that article, I turned on Alanis while organizing my thoughts on it, and there you go. The quote is from Dreebs Thornhill, a moderator from a Facebook group dedicated to discussing House of Leaves, and they said, "House of Leaves is a living, breathing thing. It's one of those things you can't relax with until you've discussed it with someone else." And here we are. And there Johnny Truant was, being dragged in the middle of the night into Zapano's apartment by his friend Lude. And going back to that dank, thought-haunted apartment, I wanted to briefly re-explore some phrases and thoughts from the introduction before we move on. I reread my notes, and I'd left some intriguing things behind. One is a fun reference to a horror movie, which there are many throughout the novel, direct and oblique. This one was the direction to Zapano's apartment. It was the last door on the left, which my scream queen mind saw as a reference to Wes Craven's infamous 1971 movie, The Last House on the Left, a movie about getting lost by getting hooked up with the wrong people, and about a proper white suburban nuclear family actually being dangerous. This is a signpost to later, as you'll see. The next is just a phrase I liked that Johnny used to describe Zapano's apartment. The scent of human history. That's delicious. So evocative. And in that apartment, he saw the deracinated details of Zapano's life. Not a word I was familiar with, so I looked it up. It means uprooted from one's natural environment. Appropriate to this novel, as you will see when we talk about the Navidson family. And also a lovely word to use to describe Zapano's nest of an apartment, which he'd filled with books, papers, and information from elsewhere, wall-to-wall obsession. As Johnny Truant said, there were even books in the refrigerator. Another phrase Johnny used, this time to describe the Navidson record as he found it in the apartment, quote, "lost in the twist of so many dangerous sentences." The first labyrinth in this novel. Finally, two more things were mentioned in the introduction that sent me down a rabbit hole. The first was a reference to the Maginot Line. It's a metaphor for expensive efforts that offer a false sense of security. The actual Maginot Line was a huge barrier of concrete fortifications and obstacles, plus weapons installations that were set up by France in the 1930s on their side of the borders of Germany, Luxembourg, Italy, and Switzerland to deter Germany from invading. It was based upon France's experience with trench warfare in World War I, so it did not extend to the English Channel. So it had a big old hole in it, basically, in my limited experience, understanding of warfare. Whoops! The other was Johnny Truant's reference to Joel Peter Witkin. Joel Peter is hyphenated. He was a controversial American photographer who focused on disturbing themes. He claimed that he witnessed a car accident as a child, the result of which decapitated a child, and that trauma informed his adult work. He focused on death, corpses, and outsiders of his time, intersex individuals, dwarfism, and the disabled and deformed. He also liked to photograph his subjects in religiously inspired tableaus, you know, like The Last Supper. There's a documentary about him and his work called Joel Peter Witkin, An Objective Eye. I'll link to it in the show notes. Both of these references are definitely intriguing given this novel's themes. Untrustworthy safety, spending a lot of money and effort to find yourself back where you started, thinking you're safe because of your white picket fence barrier, disturbing images of the outsider and things maybe we would rather not see, and this will make sense in a moment with regard to Will Navidson. Can we trust images? What is too upsetting to witness, photograph, film? Quote, Zapano writes constantly about seeing, what we see, how we see, and what in turn we can't see. Over and over, in one form or another, he returns to the subject of light, space, shape, line, color, focus, tone, contrast, movement, rhythm, perspective, and composition, none of which is surprising considering Zappano's piece centers on a documentary film called The Navidson Record, made by a Pulitzer Prize-winning photojournalist who must somehow capture the most difficult subject of all, the side of darkness itself. Now we delve into the unique structure of the novel, which is often what puts people off from reading it. I've heard it called everything up and down the spectrum. Intimidating, precious, fascinating, self-indulgent, obnoxious. The technical name for it is ergodic. ergodic. Here's why you allow me to get a little quote-unquote precious or self-indulgent and dive into this concept. It's defined by Epson G. Arseth, which is a great name, in his book, Cybertext, Perspectives on Ergodic Literature. Quote, in ergodic literature, non-trivial effort is required to allow the reader to transverse the text. If ergodic literature is to make sense as a concept, there must also be non-ergodic literature, where the effort to transverse the text is trivial, with no extra nomadic responsibilities placed upon the reader except, for example, eye movement and the periodic or arbitrary turning of pages. Unquote. Extra nomadic being an awesome word, meaning occurring outside the confines of human thought, which perfectly describes the Navidson's house and the Navidson record to a great extent. Any document that makes the reader lose touch with reality could be described as extra nomadic, yes? And it's not, I mean, my accent, it's not nomadic, like a nomad, it's N-O-E. So it's E-X-T-R-A-N-O-E-M-A-T-I-C. I know sometimes I tend to slur words because of fatigue and because of my southern accent, so I want to make sure I got that one right. The word ergodic is from the Greek ergon, which means work, and hodos, which means path. The path requires work from the walker. I love words. The third word of note in Arseth's work is cybertext. That originated with Bruce Boston, a speculative fiction poet. In reading cybertext, each reader obtains a different outcome based upon the choices they make while reading it. So think of those Choose Your Own Adventures book. You know, if you want to pull a sword, turn to page 26. If you want to sheath your sword, turn to page 28. Cybertext has navigation options and a feedback loop between the reader and the book. Here's how House of Leaves qualifies. You can choose to read the subtitles later, at the end of the section, then go back and read that section's subtitles, or you can read each subtitle in each subtitle's subtitle in order as you go. They're layered. You can explore the frontispiece image and the small images on the spine in great detail before you read the book as you read, or you can avoid them until after you read the novel, after which you can go then explore them and the internet's theories on them and so on and so on. To quote Johnny Truant, describing Zappano's documentation of the Navidson record. Endless snarls of words, sometimes twisting into meaning, sometimes into nothing at all, frequently breaking apart, always branching off into other pieces I'd come across later. On old napkins, the tattered edges of an envelope, once even on the back of a postage stamp. Everything and anything but empty, each fragment completely covered with the creep of years and years of ink pronouncements. Layered, crossed out, amended, handwritten, typed, legible, illegible, impenetrable, lucid, torn, stained, scotch-taped, some bits crisp and clean, others faded, burnt, or folded and refolded so many times the creases had obliterated whole passages of God knows what, sense, truth, deceit, a legacy of prophecy or lunacy or nothing of the kind. And in the end, achieving, designated, describing, recreating, find your own words. I have no more, or plenty more, but why? And all to tell what? A great example of cybertext is the poetry prose of Ellen Hopkins. She writes really thick novels in poetry form about the experiences of teenagers struggling with addiction, family strife, and mental illness. Some of her poems can be read in two different ways. Left to right and up to down, as you usually read text written in English, and also by only reading the text isolated on the right-hand side of the page, or by only reading the first word of each line. The poem thus becomes two different poems. You can choose to read both then and there, or come back to the second one later, or neglect the second one altogether. The book becomes different books depending upon the reader's actions. I will link to her thoughtful and beautiful books in the show notes and the website entry for this episode. So House of Leaves is ergodic and extra-nomadic cybertext because of the nature of its text and the text format and typography. And I'll post pictures online as we delve deeper. There are footnotes and footnotes of the footnotes. There are blank pages with purpose. There are pages with only one or two words designed to draw you in further as moments of silence. There are pages where the text is written in a square, and so on. The cover itself is ergodic. As I described in the first episode, there's a labyrinth printed on it that can only be seen in certain light or if the book is tilted a certain way. Also, the presumed slipcover is cut in such a way so that it's too short for the book itself. It folds inside the cover, but if you try to fit it the way a slipcover normally does, it folds the book completely out of true. The front cover and slipcover are also shorter than the book itself. It seems nothing fits to true in the Navidson record or the Navidson house. The book literally has the design of a labyrinth. You get lost inside it, and many readers wander back and forth, flipping to references and footnotes to previous and further chapters. The book is its own maze. The typography is part of the ergodic design as well. As you begin reading the Navidson record itself, you'll see a footnote from the quote-unquote editors that notes and footnotes from Zapano are in Times font, and footnotes and notes added by Johnny Truant are in the same typewriter font, Courier, as the introduction is. Other examples of ergodic and extra-pneumatic literature. The Griffin and Sabine series by Nick Bancock, which involves, amongst other things, a collection of physical letters and envelopes between the two characters that the reader must physically handle and read. And Marisha, I hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly, Pessel's outstanding novel Night Film, about an underground film that supposedly makes the viewers insane and the search for its missing filmmaker. And Vladimir Nabokov's Pale Fire. One could argue, giving all the French used and deeply layered literary references, that Nabokov's Lolita and his Ada or Ardor, A Family Chronicle, are on the ergodic continuum, because they require work from the reader. I have linked to all these books in the show notes, as usual. There's a list on Goodreads of ergodic literature that you can vote upon and add to. I've linked to it in the show notes as well. I have not read the Griffin and Sabine series, but it's always been on my TBR list. I have not read Pale Fire either, but it's on my bucket list. Lolita is one of my favorite novels because the language astounds me, and it's taught me a great deal about writing and psychology. I recently read Ada or Ardor and learned the proper pronunciation of the title to properly enjoy all the wordplay and puns. It's Ada, not Ada, as it looks. You rhyme it with Ardor. It, along with all of Nabokov, is on my bucket list, and it blew my mind. It did require a great deal of work, and I'm not done with it. I'm not done with going through all the cultural references I didn't quite get, and the appendix written as Nabokov's alter ego, which explains all of the French and Russian expressions and the multi-layered puns in the text. It's incredible, but it's not for everyone, because it's a very peculiar novel about a rather disturbed family, and it contains heavy themes of suicide and incest, so just a heads up. Anyway, meandering back to the Navidson house and the Navidson family. And just a note, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, but I'm going to continue to say Navidson, because there's a note that in one of the films, Karen refers to Will Navidson by the nickname Navy. So I'm not sure if it's Navidson, but that just feels really awkward in my mouth. So I'm just saying Navidson. I apologize to rabid fans if I'm pronouncing it wrong. The social impact of this novel when it was first published was unbelievable. I was on LiveJournal then, back in those days, and LJ exploded with this book. Suddenly everyone was obsessed with the book and Poe's companion album. On LiveJournal, you could add what you were listening to with each post, and everyone's post had some track from the Haunted album suddenly. Someone learned how to make words different colors, which was high technology back then on Humble LJ, and passed it along. And every post about House of Leaves had the word house in bright blue. Obsession. The posts are probably all still there from everyone who left their LJ up in public. So you can have fun searching livejournal.com or searching the Wayback Machine for the other popular blogging sites back then, which were Blogger, TextPattern, and TypePad. As I said in the first episode, the book begins with the quote, "This is not for you." And the internet took that challenge and ran with it. Never tell a young blogger not to touch something. This is a quote from the Guardian article that explored the impact of the novel 20 years on last spring, and the link's in the show notes. Quote, "Two decades on, Daniel Elsky sees his relationship with his first book as that of a slightly distant parent. Look at it this way," he says. "House of Leaves is a kid. I'm that kid's dad. By now that kid has made a lot of friends, forged close ties, has a multitude of personal relationships I know nothing about. Now and then, my kid's friends think it's cool to meet the dad, but they don't want the dad hanging around for too long. They're not friends with the dad, they're friends with my kid." I find this fascinating, especially given the Facebook group's moderator's quote about the book being a living, breathing thing. It's also a different take than most authors. It's really like he birthed it out of his head and his grief, and now it's free and sentient and separate from him. He did revisit his work on the 20th anniversary and reread it cover to cover. The article described it as, quote, "re-entering the maze." He said, quote, "I was proud, humbled, astonished, unsettled. At the end, I sobbed." Remember, this novel and Poe's companion album were birthed, so to speak, because of a death, the death of their father. That humbles me, frankly, to be allowed to share in their creative feelings. Thank you to you both. To swing back around to that quote I read, describing Zapano's massive documents about the Navidson record that Johnny and Lou had found in Zapano's department, it describes a fascinating psychological symptom that hides in the dark corners of this novel, hypergraphia. At the heart of the labyrinth of this story is the obsession with documentation. Zapano's writings, Johnny's writings, and Navidson's videotapings. You see hypergraphia in horror movies. The most recognizable and terrifying depiction is John Doe in the movie Seven. You see his writing in his, you discover, hundreds of notebooks during the gorgeously awful main credits. His writing is cramped and voluminous and fills page after page after notebook with his obsessive thoughts that can't be stopped. Other horror movies, like 2011's Grave Encounters and 1994's In the Mouth of Madness, directed by John Carpenter, do you read Sutter Kane? show it as a psychiatric hospital patient's compulsion, as they are doomed to write on the walls and floor of their own hospital room. The drive to write is connected with the limbic system in the frontal lobe, the emotion and communication center of the brain, and its failure to properly communicate with the temporal lobe is the problem in hypergraphia. Hypergraphia is considered a psychological symptom rather than a disorder. As with most things to do with mental health, it's the amount to which the symptom is interfering with the activities of daily life that determine whether or not it's disordered. Thank you for allowing me to use my psychology and counseling degrees today. Hypergraphia is often seen as a symptom of temporal lobe epilepsy, as well as bipolar disorder and other manic disorders, schizophrenia, and dementias. Certain injuries to the brain can also cause the overwhelming urge to write. The blog Bipolar 101, linked in the show notes, talks about their own experiences with bipolar disorder and hypergraphia, and wonders about the age-old question of the relations between creativity and madness, and its relations to hypergraphia, which is a fascinating question for this novel. Would one need to be mad to go down this rabbit hole and chronicle the Navidson record in writing? Would such hypergraphia drive one mad? Can you come back from such a journey? Think about it, and think about Johnny Truant's descriptions of it, the months and months of writing Zapano had to have done in that spooky, cramped apartment, alone, the only sound the scramblings of the primitive spiders, the distant LA traffic, and the frantic scratchings of his pen against his notebook paper, his napkins, his matchbook covers. He was not only chasing a mystery, his brain was literally chemically obsessed with the activity of doing so. Who knows if he ate or slept? And the mystery itself, as we will discuss, was so disturbing that it was a waking nightmare. That hole doesn't have handholds to climb back up from, my friends. And Johnny Truant falls right in after him, as you will see when we begin reading the record. He cannot help himself from adding his own long and rambling footnotes. There was one more word I didn't recognize in the introduction, and it fits perfectly. Prolix. P-R-O-L-I-X. Used by Johnny. It means tediously prolonged, wordy, tending to speak or write at excessive length. Quote, I could not stop, and it sucked me away from family and friends. Sensations outside of language dried up. Music became irritating discord. The visual world grew faint. Alice W. Flatterley, The Midnight Disease, The Drive to Write, Writer's Block, and The Creative Brain. Flaherty got her the title of her memoir, interestingly enough for this podcast, from another sufferer of hypergraphia. It's how he described his obsession. And that would be Edgar Allan Poe. Everything is connected, as I always say. Especially, it seems, when it comes to this eerie novel. Another Jungian House of Leaves connection is not only hypergraphia, but hypergraphy, which is the combining of text with visual material. This novel, about a hypergraphic character, is a study in ergodic hypergraphy. I love serendipity and I love wordplay, but y'all know this. I'm having such fun. So, with all this high strangeness in mind, we begin reading the Navidson record itself, which the book has told us not to do. This is not for you. Now, there may be some confusion. The title of the Navidson record refers to both Zapano's and Johnny Truant's collections of writings on the subject of Will Navidson's film and to the film itself. I will try to be precise as I can as we go along as to which I'm referring. This universe gets willfully blurry. So for this episode, I'm talking about the first three sections through page 18. I will definitely speed up as we go along, but this first part explains what the film is and its place in time and space and who the Navidson family is. So I felt it was good to linger here. As always, I'm not going to spoil everything, and I'm leaving lots of items for you to discover. More serendipity. Will Navidson, when the films that make up the records were shot, and I'll explain that in a minute, was my age. He's 48. Or the footnote says they determined him to be 48, which I found interesting language. I'm 49. Also, their demented domicile, which as you know is my personal term for any house that is not right, on Ashtree Lane is in Virginia, which is where I live. So the Navidson family is Will, a photojournalist who won the Pulitzer Prize for a disturbing wartime photograph. He was often away for work trips that became extended. His longtime partner is Karen Green, 37, a successful model. They've chosen to move to this small Virginia town and this house to start over and get away from the city. They have both promised to stay home. He has grants to make a documentary about starting over in small town life, a nuclear family nesting in their new home, and he places cameras all over the house like in a Paranormal Activity movie. Note, this was written decades before one of those movies. I'm just making the visual reference. They have two children, Daisy, 5, and Chad, 8. The other people seen and or heard in the videos are Will's brother, Tom, and Will's friend, Billy Preston. Will and Karen also agree to do FaceTime video diaries for the documentaries with their own cameras. All of this footage, plus the oddities to come, become the movie, The Navidson Record. The date is approximately April 1990, so that would be 1 month before I graduated from high school, which is apropos of nothing, except more serendipity. So much of this novel is prescient. One of the first quotes worries about what would become deepfakes. For those of you who don't know what a deepfake is, a skilled editor can now insert someone into someone else's place in a movie. Look up Jim Carrey in The Shining. His face has replaced Jack Nicholson's in a scene, and to me, the implications of this technology are deeply disturbing. This is the quote from page 3. This leading obsession, validate or invalidate the reels and tapes, invariably bring up a collateral and more general concern. Whether or not, with the advent of digital technology, image has forsaken its once impeachable hold on the truth. Will Navidson, of course, did not care what the many, many pundits and critics said, and remained afraid of the house on Ashtree Lane. Quote, Will Navidson, however, remains stalwart in his insistence that the documentary should be taken literally. As he himself says, "All this, don't take it as anything else but this. And if one day you find yourself passing by that house, don't stop. Don't slow down. Just keep going. There's nothing there. Beware." I am really interested in Will's use of the word nothing. I think it's positive with meaning, as in a nothing. The first the public hears of the Navidson family and what becomes of the film, The Navidson Record, are two VHS tapes. The first is the 5.5-minute hallway. The second, which the public learns about a year later, is called Exploration Number 4. Keeping up with Poe's companion album, the first has a directly related song, which has intriguing lyrics given the family dynamic and the horror of the novel both, so I'll include them here. Quote, "I live at the end of a 5.5-minute hallway, but as far as I can see, you are still miles from me in your doorway. And oh, by the way, when the landlord came today, he measured everything. I knew he'd get it wrong, but I just played along, because I was hoping that would fix it all. But there's only so far I can go. When you're living in a hallway that keeps growing, I think to myself, 5 more minutes and I'll be there. Inside your door, but there's more to this story than I've exposed. There are words made of letters unwritten, and yes, I forgive you for leading me on. You can think of it like this when you can't resist. I'm in your hallway standing on a cliff, and just when I think I can find the trick, I'm tumbling like an echo." I will very briefly summarize the two videos, leaving you to discover the creepy details. The first is the demonstration by Will, who's holding the camera, that his house is bigger on the inside than the outside. His friend Billy and his brother Tom are present, as well as Karen. There is a door that should not be there on the inside of an outside wall, and when Will opens it, there is a long, dark hallway. The second tape is disjointed and introduces someone else who names himself as if he's afraid he won't be found and talks of being lost. Holloway Roberts of Minomi, Wisconsin. You can hear Will talking about wanting to burn the house down, and you see blood and Daisy crying. This tape is quite creepy and has a found footage horror movie feel to it. I was curious, so I checked. The Blair Witch Project came out in 1999. Pantheon published this book in April 2000, but it had been circulating for longer before that. This may have just been something else serendipitous about the novel, or something else Danielewski foresaw, or both, or it may have been inspiration, I don't know. So people passed around dubs of these movies, and the crappier the dubs became, the creepier it got. For those of you who weren't around for VHS tapes or haven't seen The Ring, the more you watch a tape, the more you wear it out naturally, and it gets little glitches and such in the viewing. And then you copy it, and the copy is a bad version of the original. So people were copying copies, and the worse quality they were watching, the creepier the 5.5-minute hallway and Exploration 4 looked. 3 years later, Miramax compiled and edited these two tapes and all the tapes from Will's documentary project and put out the movie, The Navidson Record. So that's the movie version as opposed to the paper version written and compiled by Zappano and Johnny Truant. Note on the guy on Exploration 4, doing their ergodic work, I looked up Minomi, Wisconsin, because Minomi sounded like the word monomic, and I'm not pronouncing it right. I thought it was a play on words, but it's not. It's a lovely little town of about 16,000 people. So the two tapes were an underground obsession, just like the original edition of this novel were amongst Danielewski's friends and friends of friends, its sheaf of papers echoing Zappano's sheaf of obsession. Documentary became an international obsession, everyone becoming an expert overnight on whether it was real or not, with Will Navidson proving the existence of the paranormal with a real haunted house, or was this a professional photographer trying to trick the world for money and fame? One more rabbit hole before I end this episode. The Navidson Record begins with an appropriate quote, the line from the Beatles song A Day in the Life, "I saw a film today, oh boy." This song, I found out, was in part inspired by John Lennon's reading a story in the newspaper about the heir to the Guinness fortune, Tara Brown, dying when he crashed his car into a parked van. He changed that up into blew his mind out in a car. But that explains the lyrics. I read the news today, oh boy. So the quote that begins the Navidson record refers to a fatal accident. There are no coincidences in this novel. I hope you've enjoyed the second episode in the series. The third is coming shortly because, like all parties involved, I'm obsessed. I promise not to go down any new hallways that appear. But I leave you with this question. If you, like Will and Karen, found an impossible doorway in your home, would you open it? Would you enter it? Until part three, remember that I am uploading all scripts and ad-free feed to Patreon. All episodes will eventually be uploaded. Thank you for all your continued support in this, my fifth year. Also remember that I love you and stay safe. Quote, if finally categorized as a gothic tale, contemporary urban folk myth, or merely a ghost story, as some have called it, the documentary will still, sooner or later, slip the limits of any one of those genres. Too many important things in the Navidson record jut out past the borders. Where one might expect horror, the supernatural, or traditional paroxysms of dread and fear, one discovers disturbing sadness, a sequence on radioactive isotopes, or even laughter over a Simpsons episode.